4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WVBF Middleborough, WRRS Middleborough, WRRSLP Pittsfield, WLLO Londonderry, WVALLP Athol, WDJM Framingham.
Let's begin today's reading of the Boston Herald. For today, it is Tuesday, the 29th of November, 2022, and we say hello today to Claire and Mary Ellen.
Welcome, everyone. This is Mary Ellen.
And Claire, I'm glad you're with us. And the front page of the Boston Herald this morning has a beautiful picture of the Prince and Princess of Wales, who will be visiting the Hub. The article is entitled, however, Royal Pain. So, here we go. The headline is The Royals Roll into Town for Earthshot Prize. It's written by Matthew Metzger, who is with the Boston Herald. The British are coming. The Prince and Princess of Wales, William and Kate, arrive here tomorrow with Friday's Earthshot Prize, the big-ticket event that will include President Biden. But William and Kate are set to kick off their Hub Stop welcome event at City Hall Plaza at 4:45 p.m. for a welcoming event. They will also catch the Celtics game later. They visit Roca in Chelsea on Thursday to see the nonprofit's, quote, intervention model in action, unquote, according to a tweet. Next will be a stop at Greentown Labs in Somerville. On Friday, Kate swings by the Center on the Developing Child at Harvard University, while William goes for a tour of the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library and Museum in Dorchester. But the marquee item is Friday evening for a swank Earthshot Prize announcement. Quote, I am so excited to celebrate these 15 finalists and see the five winners of the Earthshot Prize announced in Boston, the hometown of President John F. Kennedy, who shared the Earthshot Prize's belief that seemingly impossible goals are within reach if we only harness the limitless power of innovation, human ingenuity, and urgent optimism, Prince William said. The Prince and Princess of Wales will be in the Back Bay Friday to award £1 million, or about $1.2 million, to five of 15 finalists participating in the second Earthshot Prize. The contest, returning for its second year, hopes to have awarded £50 million by 2030 to entrepreneurs and innovators aiming to tackle climate change. Quote, the groundbreaking, innovative work of the 2022 finalists leaves me inspired and hopeful that we can solve the significant challenges facing us today. Whether it's taking care of our planet or healing our communities, each of us can and must step up to do our part. Thank you to this year's finalists for leading the way. Actor and director co-host Daniel Dae Kim said in a Monday statement announcing this year's entertainment lineup for the event. The 15 finalists were selected from over 1,000 submissions by the group's self-described expert advisory panel, consisting of scientists, academics, and subject matter experts from various climate and environment-related disciplines. Friday's event, to be held at the MGM Music Hall in Fenway, will include an all-star lineup of performers in addition to prize finalists. According to the organizers, quote, this year's awards will feature unforgettable performances from singer-songwriter and activist Annie Lennox, Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter Billie Eilish, accompanied by her brother and creative partner Phineas, R&B duo Chloe and Halle, and platinum-selling artist and activist Ellie Goulding, unquote. Sir David Attenborough, famed for his work on nature documentaries, will participate in the ceremonies, and the Prince of Wales will deliver closing remarks, according to organizers. The five prize categories are the Prize to Protect and Restore Nature, the Prize to Clean Our Air, the Prize to Revive Our Oceans, the prize to build a waste-free world, and the prize to fix our climate. 15 teams representing 10 different countries are left for consideration, 3 in each category.
Thank you so much, Claire. There is a related commentary by Joe Battenfeld entitled "Lots of Traffic and Curtsying." Dysfunctional royal family head to the hub. Joe Battenfeld, a columnist for the Herald. Get ready for traffic disruptions, a big taxpayer bill, and a lot of needless bowing and curtsying. The dysfunctional royal family is coming to the Boston area starting Wednesday, with Prince William and Princess Kate headlining a packed 3-day public relations tour aimed partly at burnishing the royals' bruised image. There will be plenty of stars, politicians, and Kennedys, all desperate to get invited to the big events. The trip, the first to the U.S. since the death of the Queen, will be the first close look many Bostonians will get of William and Kate, who are locked in a PR battle with royal outcasts Harry and Meghan for the hearts and minds of the public. William and Kate are the future faces of the crown, while Harry and Meghan are more like celebrities who don't always get great press. That's why it's so important for William and Kate to perform their roles while in Boston and not screw up. Showing up unannounced at a Bruins or Celtics game wouldn't be a bad idea to win over Americans. The first stop for the Prince and Princess of Wales will be Boston City Hall, that concrete and brick eyesore, where Boston's own version of royalty, Mayor Michelle Wu, will be trying to welcome the couple to town. Couldn't the city have come up with a better venue than that? Boston is full of beautiful old buildings and historic places, and they offer up Boston City Hall Plaza. Helpful tip for Wu: don't hold an umbrella for the prince or princess if it's raining. Former Boston mayor and Vatican ambassador never lived it down when he did that for the Pope. The most sought-after ticket for the royal trip is for the Earthshot Prize Awards on Friday, where singers Billie Eilish, her brother Phineas — you know you're big when your name is all in caps, and his name is spelled F-I-N-N-E-A-S, all in caps — Annie Lennox and Chloe and Halle will be performing. Kate, and whatever fabulous dress she'll be wearing, will be presenting the awards along with actors Rami Malek, Shailene Woodley, and Catherine O'Hara.
You're listening to World Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information. Located in Lowell, Massachusetts, we read local news editorials, feature stories, and more. Lab Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff at the Lowell Association for the Blind. This is Elizabeth. I will be reading to you from the Lowell Sun, Tuesday, November 29th. Lowell Fitchburg among communities with the lowest turnout, by Cameron Mossberger. Despite the higher-than-expected election turnout across Massachusetts this year, at 51.4%, Lowell saw the third lowest turnout in the Commonwealth at just 29.7%. The Mill City was ahead of only Springfield and Lawrence, which had 24.9 and 22.8 turnout, respectively. In North Central Massachusetts, Fitchburg fared a bit better at just 40%. In stark comparison, many smaller communities from Greater Fitchburg to Greater Lowell saw upwards of 60%. Some communities such as Littleton and Harvard in the Neshoba Valley saw nearly 70%. Secretary of State William Galvin's office released full breakdowns of each of the 351 towns and cities in the state of Mass on Monday, stating that more than 2.5 million people cast their ballots in the midterms this year, though there was a slightly higher turnout in 2018 state election. Galvin stated he was delighted that more people voted than expected. But that wasn't the case in Lowell, a city of 71,798 voters. Lowell Director of Elections Greg Pappas, who started in July, said he's unsure what turnout was looked like in Lowell in years past, but has seen a gradual decline in turnout in the cities across the state, having worked in Galvin's office for several years. The city put up more signage this election cycle, Pappas said, and sent out mailings alerting residents to their new polling locations. They even had the help of local organizations, including the Cambodian Mutual Assistance Association. But people still showed up days and weeks after recent elections thinking they could vote. The city council was very involved, all the departments were, it seemed like everybody knew there was an election, but we still had people coming in days later saying, I want to vote 3 days after the primary, Pappas said. We saw people coming in last week asking to vote, I just don't know how to explain that. About 63% of the Lowell turnout voted in person on election day, which is higher than the state average of 55.1% this year. Pappas said some of the polling places were unusually slow after 5 p.m. when turnout typically picks up. One reason for the low numbers could be the races themselves, Pappas said. The bigger turnouts are always where the state rep races are, the state Senate following that, but we didn't have any of those, Pappas said. Senator Ed Kennedy had no opposition, and Reps Ratty Mom and Van Howard didn't have opposition. It was just that one small part of Lowell, the other part went into Chelmsford. State Representative elect Rodney Elliott, who won in an open seat in the 16th Middlesex District, was also partly running in Chelmsford, Pappas added, so it wasn't solely a Lowell-based race. Fitchburg also saw significantly lower voter turnout compared to surrounding communities. Only 39.4% of its 25,878 voters voted this fall. But Fitchburg City Clerk Joanna Bellata said it was actually a little busier at the polls than expected, adding that the historical data falls in line with the numbers of votes cast. They put out flyers and mailers, advertised the warrant in the newspaper, and send electronic memos to local businesses to promote upcoming elections, Bellata said. There's also an announcement at the end of the city council meetings to remind residents to vote, Bellata said. So she couldn't explain the turnout results. We were with the Department of Justice have hit the demographic that everything with elections in English and Spanish for our Spanish community. So we're working very hard on that and trying to reach out to those voters as well. The Twin Cities were far from identical in their turnout. Neighborhood Leominster saw 49.3% turnout, but was still below average. In Ashby, a town with only 2,598 voters, the vast majority, 69.8%, waited until election day to cast their ballots. But in Chelmsford, 42.5% of the town's 26,730 registered voters voted by mail and 10.2% voted early, according to Galvin's office. Most people, 55.1% statewide, voted on election day, 37.4% voted by mail, and only 7.5% voted early. Of the communities in the Lowell Sun's core coverage area, Littleton had the highest turnout percentage at 67.7%. Nearly every community in Greater Lowell had turnout percentages above the state average, but Dracut fell just below at 49.7%. The highest overall turnout in the Greater region was seen in Harvard and Carlisle, which had 69.7 and 71.8, respectively. A full alphabetical list of area voters' turnout is below. Water main break forces evacuations. By Melanie Curtis and Melanie Gilbert and Aaron Curtis Lowell. A major water main break just before 3:30 p.m. Monday, spewing thousands of gallons of water into several neighborhood streets in the acre, forcing the evacuation of hundreds of residents. We receive a report of a water main break in the area of Father Morris Head Boulevard by Suffolk Street, said Police Department Deputy Superintendent Mark LeBlanc. Responding officers arrived on the scene to find an active and substantial flow of water in the area, to include parts of Father Morissette Boulevard, Moody and Cabot Streets. Officers secured the area and worked with the Lowell Fire Department in evacuating affected residents. Sources in the Lowell Regional Water Utility, who did not want to be named, said that the break occurred at a gate valve on a water main. A large sinkhole emerged from the receding waters once the water main was capped, at which point residential operations were started. Deputy Fire Chief Bob Destramp said firefighters were forced to evacuate residents of four single-family homes located on Race Street due to flooded basements. Even more demanding was the evacuation of 192 units of City View Towers run by Lowell Housing Authority and located at 657 Merrimack Street. The building is home to senior residents and people who are disabled. According to Destramp, the water entered the basement, causing issues with the building's electrical system. All of the transformers are all down in the basement, and it was getting hairy as the water was coming up, Destramp said. Some of the electrical was starting to smoke a little, and there was a transformer that blew, and it was pushing smoke into the building. National Grid was called to the scene, the power was shut off, and the decision was made to evacuate the building. Destramp said firefighter crews went to each floor to help all residents, which included those who were unable to walk themselves out of the eight-story structure. Extensive manpower was needed for this operation, Destramp said. Everybody got out safe, nobody got hurt, everybody has been calm and been very orderly, with some belongings in hand. Guy Quinn, 72, who has lived at City View Towers for about 6 years, stood outside the building shortly before 8 p.m. According to Quinn, he was waiting for some family members to pick him up. I certainly wasn't expecting it, Quinn said. I thought they would fix it, and I guess they wouldn't do that. They want to make sure everything is all right. Curtis Chantabom of Lowell said he saw the gushing water trap cars and lap the front porches of several homes with knee-deep water. Houses and cars are surrounded by water, he said. The fire department did a water boat rescue to some of the houses, and one family got out. Priscilla Gonzalez, who lives in the apartment complex off Ray Street, said she was concerned about the condition of her car that was sitting in the complex's now flooded parking lot. The water reached nearly the top of the car's tires. I wasn't able to move it, Gonzalez said about the car. The water was already past my knee, and the water was so cold. The Lowell Senior Center at 276 Broadway and the Mercier Center at 21 Salem Street were open for area residents affected by the water main break, and the Massachusetts Emergency Management Agency and Salvation Army Disaster Services were assisting. The Lowell Regional Water Utility posted a water main break alert on the city website at 5:15. There was a large water main break in the downtown area, which is affecting many areas within the city. Unfortunately, while this emergency repair is being addressed, you will experience discolored water or low pressure. Once the repair had been made, the utility advised the water pressure will return to normal. Brown or discolored water can be cleared by running the cold water taps for approximately 10 minutes. The Lowell Police Department also issued a traffic advisory for motorists to seek alternate routes and to expect delays. The AR Garage at 11 Post Office Square will be open for free parking for residents in the affected area. We'll move over to the local news page. Drake it. Roll over insurance ends in resignation by Prudence Brighton. In New England, weather cooperates. Drake it residents can get out their skates and sleds and head over to Beaverbrook Farm for a few hours of winter fun. But the brouhaha that might have blocked these proposed activities resulted in the resignation of Josh Taylor from the Beaverbrook Ad Hoc Committee and the Conservation Commission and Community Preservation Commission. Taylor ran for a seat on the Board of Selectmen earlier this year but lost. The Beaverbrook Ad Hoc Committee is not the only committee in the town spotlight. The Zoning Bylaw Review Committee stirred some controversy during last week's Board of Selectmen meeting. The issue is that the addition to two alternate committee members to solve the problem of absenteeism on the board. In the audio tape obtained by The Sun, the most recent Beaverbrook committee meeting, Taylor tangled with town manager Ann Vandal over the question of insurance. He ended the argument by resigning. Voices on the tape were sometimes muffled, but both Vandal and Taylor agreed that he resigned in the midst of the discussion and walked out the door. Someone in the room laughed when Taylor said he resigned. I didn't see that coming, the voice said. Vandal maintained that the town was not insured for activities such as skating and sledding, and Taylor insisted it was. In a statement to The Sun on Monday, Vandal said her office is supportive of the ice rink and sledding at the insurance company's insistence, and to reduce the town's liability for such events, we have always required outside associations not affiliated with the town provide an insurance binder for events held on town property. As an example, when private parties are held to Harmony Hall, the hosts are required to provide an insurance binder, and when the Boy Scouts or like groups hold events at Beaverbrook Farm, they're also required to provide an insurance binder, her statement continued. The Friends of Beaverbrook are planning a skating rink and a sledding area. They are also required to provide a binder, which they have agreed to. The town should not bear the cost of any injuries sustained at activities that the Friends of Beaverbrook Farm or any other events a private entity holds on town property, Vandal said. According to Taylor, on the morning after an ad hoc committee meeting, Vandal copied him on an email exchange with the insurance company, and the company said the town has insurance for such activities. Taylor said that the skating and sledding had been under discussion for more than a year. The distinction between Vandal's argument and Taylor's would seem to be an affiliation with the town. The Friends of Beaverbrook are not affiliated with the town. The idea for sledding and skating originated last year with the Friends. Vandal said the town is actively accepting applications from interested parties for the Conservation Commission. The Conservation Commission will have to appoint a representative to the Community Preservation Committee. Taylor's replacement on the ad hoc committee will be made by Selectman Chair Allison Genest. The Zoning Bylaw Review Committee has had an attendance problem. One of the reasons is that no representative of the three-member Board of Health is able to attend. The committee consists of two representatives from the Planning Board and two from the Zoning Board of Appeals. It also consists of one representative each from the Board of Selectmen, Conservation Commission, and Board of Health. Selectman Heather Santiago Hutchings submitted a proposal to fellow board members to replace the health board representative with someone who served on the now-defunct Master Plan Committee, Selectmen agreed to consider adding two alternate members to replace the Health Board member. Two alternate members would mean an added standing if another member could not attend a meeting. Interviews for the two positions were set up and then abruptly canceled, or that it is how it appears to Santiago Hutchins. She was not notified, even though she is a selectman representative to the review committee. The decision to cancel was made at a meeting attended by Vanda Genest and Community Development Director Allison Manoogian. Santiago Hutchins let her feelings be known at the last selectman's meeting, and Vanda responded that she wasn't trying to hide anything. The interviews are being rescheduled. Lowell High students are programming their futures. Lowell, it's 2:30 p.m. on Friday afternoon, dismissal time at Lowell High School. Hundreds of students spill into the downtown streets. Some are headed to sports practice. Others are off to work or to hang out with friends. Something else is happening inside the building. In room 237, two dozen students, laptops open, are eagerly honing their coding skills, learning the computer programming language Python under the direction of their peers, senior Kenneth Chapp and junior Ibrahim Amon, co-founder of LHS's newest computer science club, the Programming Initiative, TPI. Nearly 80 students tune in online through Google Classroom, where Chapp and Amon upload the presentations from their weekly coding sessions. Python is generally used in all applications like machine learning, Chapp said. At the end of the course, club members will also be able to make applications on Discord. Following the recent drops in high school MCAS, science, technology, and engineering scores across the state, now more than ever, it is becoming dire to increase access to fun, interactive STEM experiences. Last summer, Chapp and Amon met through Google Coursera certificate program offered by a local educational nonprofit, Project Learn. The cost per student for Google Coursera program is $500, and through grants and corporate sponsorships, Project Learn can deliver IT support, data analytics, and project management certifications to 50 students this year at no cost to them or their families. With the high demand for these programs, Project Learn Executive Director LZ Nunn anticipates doubling the number of students served to 100 next year. These students are so jazzed about what they learn and empowered to gain tech-savvy skills they can use at a future job, said Nunn. This is a program that can really deliver on preparing our young people for jobs of tomorrow. We wanted to do the Google Coursera program because I saw the course as an opportunity in a specific field that I was interested in, said Amon. After completing the Google Coursera program, Chapp and Amon left inspired to start their own club that would be open and accessible to all of their classmates at the high school. We wanted to create a club that is a way for people to explore their programming interests, and that computer science is like without being completely invested in. We even have programming challenges for beginners, so that way they don't stare at us confused looking at all the code. They can actually type it out and interact with it. Chapp and Amon said that they came up with the idea of starting a computer science-focused club at LHS because they wanted more opportunities for students to learn about science-related fields beyond biology, chemistry, and physics. Outside those sciences, there aren't many computer science classes, explained Chapp. There are only three offered at our high school, and there is no AP computer science. This isn't a Lowell High problem. According to a recent report by the Massachusetts Business Alliance for Education, only 6% of high school schoolers in Massachusetts took a foundational computer science course in 2019 or 2020. Kenneth and Ibrahim are an outstanding example of students who not only saw a gap but also took concrete steps to create positive change, said Mara Bookman, program director at Project Learn. When they both brought up the idea of starting, we wanted to do everything we could to support them. Project Learn provides a budget of $1,000 toward TPI's program supplies and $500 to both Chapman and Admin and Amen. Bookman continued, breaking down barriers in the STEM field starts at the school level, and change is the most powerful when it's led, student-led. TPI member Victoria Prack, a senior at Lowell High School, said she was interested in joining to explore future career options, and because of her interest in computer science, she said she is learning a lot and likes Chap's teaching style. He does a good job of giving examples and demonstrates, Prack said. In a recent class, Chap, who has applied for early decision to MIT to study computer science, explained the different applications of Python and how to use it by utilizing relatable examples such as data related to favorite Halloween candy or temperature of porridge in the Goldilocks and the Three Bears. Making the data sources simple provides an easier path to understanding how the program works. I like that we can express our passion for programming and spread it to everyone else, Chap said. I am looking forward to bringing in some guest speakers. Teacher advisor Paul Moore said he has been blown away by Chap and Amon's knowledge and drive. I am here to advise, but they've done all the work, like preparing the lessons and teaching the course, he said. It's really incredible. I give them teaching technique tips, but everything else is all them. They even bring in snacks and sometimes pizza for the club. When asked if they had any advice for fellow students to see a problem and want to address it, both Chap and Amon were ready to extend their support and confidence. We should explore your interests, do research about them, and start applying what you learn to projects so that you can learn more about and implement them. Like Amon, Chap, too, encourages others to be go-getters and be the change they want to see. Don't wait around for some opportunities to come. You definitely find them online. Explore your interests and don't worry about the obstacles ahead of you, because you will eventually overcome them. The 5-minute read. Irish tenors to perform at Lowell Memorial Auditorium. The Irish Tenors, a touring musical trio who have sold out the Radio City Music Hall, the Sydney Opera House, and other notable venues, are coming to Lowell. The group will perform in concert at Lowell Memorial Auditorium on December 4th at 3 p.m. Tickets range from $39 to $99 and are available at lowellauditorium.com or by phone at 1-800-657-8774. Audience members can expect a diverse array of songs such as Danny Boy, My Heart Will Go On, Whiskey in a Jar, and more, including Christmas songs from the group's best-selling Christmas album, We Three Kings. The Irish tenors, who have performed together since 1998, are composed of vocalists Anthony Kearns, Declan Kelly, and Ronan Tynan. They are the second most successful Irish touring act behind U2 in the United States, according to a press release. There is an aching, bittersweet quality to much of Ireland's musical heritage, a melodic loveliness and emotional intensity that brings a tingle to the spine and a tear to the eye, the press release states. The dazzling technique and depth of feeling that defines this musical genre, amplified on the third power, is the hallmark of the Irish tenors. Westford Senior Center to host craft sale. This is Westford. The Friends of the Cameron Senior Center will host a holiday bazaar on Wednesday, December 7th from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Vendors will be selling crafts, jewelry, and more items, cards. Residents are encouraged to try baked goods, drink coffee, and shop for their loved ones. Proceeds from the sale go to the Friends, the nonprofit. Of the center. The senior center is located at 20 Pleasant Street. Lowell honors fallen African king honorary Lowell citizen. King and Rafa III of Mankon, a king in Bamana, Cameroon, visited Lowell in 2002 and 2007, becoming the first African king to journey to the city twice. And Rafa passed away in May after ruling for 63 years, and Cameroonian Lowellians are encouraged to honor his legacy at Lowell Town Media on Thursday, December 1st from 6 to 8. And Rafo was named an honorary Lowell Council member and Lowell citizen, and Bamida and Lowell became sister cities after his visits. The reception will include a tribute to a tribute video to the former king, as well as African refreshments. Lowell Telemedia is at 246 Market Street. The Chelmsford Art Society will hold an art show. The Chelmsford Art Society will hold its annual members' winter art show starting December 6th and running through January 28th at the Chelmsford Public Library. Photography, painting, stained glass, sculpture, digital art, mixed media, and more will all be free to view. The Society will also be accepting art submissions. Entrants can only submit up until two framed and wire artworks that were completed within the last 4 years. To register possible entries, fill out an online form at chelmswardartssociety.com on Wednesday, November 30th at 11 p.m. Members will drop off works December 5th from 5 to 8, and new artists are asked to visit the organization's website to learn more about membership. We'll read the obituaries in today's paper. Doris Gorham Abreu, 94, of Lowell. Salvador J. Chavez, 77, of St. Cloud, Florida. Manuel B. DeCuna, 87, of Lowell. Timothy Doyle, of Lowell. Gertrude H. Gill Brophy, of North Kingston, Rhode Island. Agnes E. Mastrogiacomo, 96, of Lowell. Geraldine Beatrice Ward, of Bellows Falls, Vermont. Melvin L. Landry, 73, of Tingsboro. Malcolm Porter, age 88, of Nashua, New Hampshire. Shauna E. Morris, age 47, of Lowell. Diana E. Nielsen, 77, of Lowell. And those are the obituaries in today's Lowell Sun. Now we'll move over to the opinion page, the editorial. Will healing make hospital costs clarity a priority? More than 4 years after she raised concerns about the difficulty in discerning clear pricing information for hospital services, we expect Governor-elect Mara Healey won't be too happy with a recent study that indicates calculating these costs remain a perplexing process. Finding information on health care procedures on Massachusetts hospital websites can be a circuitous or frustrating process, despite a 2019 federal law requiring hospitals to make all prices available online in a consumer-friendly format, according to a Pioneer Institute report. The conservative fiscal watchdog studied a sample of 19 hospitals in Massachusetts to gauge compliance with the Public Health Service Act, which took effect in January 2021 after the adoption of regulations by the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Researchers said the hospitals examined were of all sizes in urban, suburban, and rural areas across the state. In addition to finding great variations in prices for several common procedures, researchers determined that discounted cash price information, the rate at a hospital would charge individuals who pay cash, was unavailable for 37% of the hospitals in the study. Even when among hospitals that post some discounted cash prices, there are varying rates of compliance with posting prices of all procedures for which it is mandated, the Pioneer Health Report said. Compliance rates range from low 60% to a high of 97%. Researchers found price variations ranging from nearly 100% for the abdominal ultrasound to over 300% for an MRI of a leg joint. Other variations cited in the report include the price of mammography of both breasts, which ranged from a high at $962 at Leahy Hospital and Medical Center in Burlington to a low of $392 at South Shore Medical in Weymouth. These disparities portray a market dominated by certain systems that are able to maintain prices above competitive norms, the report said. This is why provider price transparency is crucial information to which consumers, employers, benefits managers, and other insurers should have ready access. That's been a longstanding complaint of smaller, non-aligned suburban and rural hospitals, which historically have received lower reimbursements for insurers other than the Boston-based hospitals for the same procedure with similar outcomes. The report released on Thursday includes several recommendations, including putting one administrator in charge of price transparency at each hospital, stepped up enforcement of federal pricing disclosure rules and guidance, and the federal government about the ways to make pricing websites more consumer-friendly. At the state level, the report suggests creating incentives to improve hospital compliance rates. Lack of health care price information may not be bothersome to some consumers because they have good health insurance and therefore believe that the price is unimportant, the report stated. This is a mistake, however, because we all pay for rising health care costs directly or indirectly through higher insurance premiums. In many cases, however, the lack of price transparency does present problems because of health insurance with high deductibles or situations where consumers are underinsured or uninsured. The last statement should strike a chord with Healey, our outgoing Attorney General and soon to be Governor. Acting as the state's chief law enforcement officer, back in October of 2018, she told the Health Policy Commission that it's often nearly impossible for patients to get price information before obtaining services. That's particularly concerning due to the increased enrollment in high-deductible insurance plans. Much like a Pioneer Institute report, Healey at the time cited studies indicating widely disparate pricing where the same service may cost $1,000 at one hospital and $300 at another. The system's complexity, she said, is underscored by another study that found 7 employees involved in billing activities for every 10 doctors. Healey advised the HPC that reducing financial and administrative complexity in healthcare and increasing price transparency should be goals in the continuing effort to slow cost increases that are consistently a big concern for individuals, families, businesses, and government. We don't know where the problematic cost of hospital services ranks on Healey's priority list as she becomes governor in January. It's obviously that given often confusing nature of our state's and nation's healthcare systems, finding a workable solution to competing cost factors will take more patience and perseverance than expended to date. But since healthcare costs account for about 40% of the state annual budget, it's a subject Healey can't ignore. Now we'll move over to the lifestyle section for advice from Dear Annie. Setting boundaries with loved ones around the holidays. Dear readers, as we prepared for all another holiday season, all kinds of emotions and feelings rise to the surface for all of us. Some of joy and excitement and some of disappointment or sadness. This is one of my favorite poems. When it comes to feeling, I hope you enjoy it. The Guest House by Rumi. This being human is a guest house. Every morning a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meaningness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all. Even if they are a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house, empty of its furniture, still treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight, the dark thought, the shame, the malice. Meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. Dear Annie, your column from Blessings, who is managing a difficult relationship with a daughter-in-law, could have been written by me, but from the other side. I'm the spouse who married into the family in this situation. I have never forbidden my spouse from seeing their family. I have declined to spend more than the time it takes to have a meal with them, but have offered to go back to a hotel or coffee shop if they want to continue spending time with their family. I have also suggested they go for a weekend without me. What changed was my making an ultimatum. Things changed because my spouse went to therapy. They began to make healthy boundaries in their lives and their life of our family. Their family, my mother-in-law and brother-in-law in particular, have been quite displeased with this, hence the low contact situation. They are displeased because of their narcissism and borderline personality disorder. At least that's how we treat the situation after much time and conversation with both my spouse's therapist and my marriage counselor. Our healthy boundaries protect us and our child. Their refusal to even acknowledge the boundaries and they lay blame at my feet when they don't get their access they want is causing my spouse to pull away from them even more. Please encourage the letter writer to seek counseling. They may find some peace from seeing things differently or get some suggestions on how to better interact with their daughter-in-law. Been there, signed, been there, living that. Dear Ben there, living that, thank you for sharing how you and your spouse have set healthy boundaries with your in-laws as a result of therapy and marriage counseling. It would be helpful if your spouse were to tell their mother and brother of these boundaries and not you, so that you will stop signaling you out as the problem. Perhaps in time they will come around and respect the boundaries that you and your spouse have set. Some health systems charging for MyChart. Patients who ask for their doctors to help through online portals might soon notice physicians something new, fees for their physicians' online advice. A growing number of health systems across the country are now charging for some types of messages sent through online patient portals, such as MyChart, with a fee of around $35 or less. It's a trend that's sparking mixed reactions, with some saying it only seems fair, while others seem it's a cash grab. In the Chicago area, North Shore University Health System began billing for some types of messages sent over patient portals, North Shore Connect, earlier this month. It joined Northwestern Medicine and Lurie Children's Hospital in the practice. Nationally, the Cleveland Clinic generated headlines this month when it announced it would start billing for some communications. UCSF Health in California also charges for some messages. Health system leaders say most messages remain free, and their online billing for questions that require more than a few minutes of a doctor's time, and that in the past they would likely have merited an in-person visit. Some of those messages have become increasingly complex and are replacing what have been a phone consultation or an in-person consultation, said Richard Gunding, vice president at Healthcare Financial Management Association, a professional group of healthcare finance leaders. None of us wants to sit in waiting rooms anymore after the pandemic. We're used to telehealth, we're just accessing our providers differently now. The healthcare systems are responding in kind. Some consumer advocates, however, criticize the trend as greedy. This is yet again the big business of healthcare finding ways to profit at every angle on patients, said Cynthia Fisher, founder and chairman of the Patients' Rights Advocate, a Massachusetts-based advocacy group that's been watching the trend. She worries some people will now be hesitant to ask their doctor questions out of fear that they could be charged. It really disadvantages disproportionately and harms the very people who can afford it the least, she said. North Shore announced an email to the patients this month that most messages will remain free, but patients will be billed for some requests and questions, such as a new symptoms medication adjustments, new prescriptions, flare-ups of chronic conditions, and others that require extensive time reviewing a patient's medical history. The fees will be billed to patients' insurance at North Shore. The out-of-pocket costs for people on Medicare will range from about $3 to $10, while patients with private insurance and Medicare Advantage may have co-payments similar to those in-person and video visits, said North Shore spokeswoman Colette Urban. The cost will be $35 for patients who pay without insurance. Patients must first consent to being billed before doctors answer the questions. The COVID-19 pandemic has resulted in more patients seeking virtual health care options such as video and telehealth visits, Urban said in a phone. In addition to online visits, messaging a provider via a secure portal offers consumers another way to receive quality, convenient, and accessible care. While most online messages are at no cost, there may be times when a physician response to a patient requires more complex medical decision-making and discussion. Northwestern and Lurie, which have already been billing for some messages, say very few of their MyChart messages incur charges. During a three-month period at the beginning of the year, Northwestern charged for fewer than less than 1% of the messages on its MyChart portal. Northwestern charges $35 per encounter, says spokesman Christopher King. Similarly, Lurie has charged for about 300 MyChart encounters in the last year, a sliver of the nearly 300,000 messages it received, said Dr. Ravi Patel, vice president of digital health for Lurie. The intent here is not to charge for MyChart messages, Patel said, noting that the patients aren't charged for quick queries such as those about scheduling an appointment following up after an in-person appointment or needing a medication refill. It's really for those cases where we've got a problem, a new symptom, a recurring symptom that came up again, a new rash, he said. It's just one more way for patients to access care, he said. 10 years ago, you did it in person, that was it, Patel said, adding that Lori now also does video visits. The new beauty of this is 10 years later, we've now tripled the ways in which you can get care and hopefully see patients outside the hospital. The trick for healthcare systems may be finding a balance between making sure doctors are compensated for their time while not overcharging patients for messages that don't take much work or expertise, said John Hargraves, director of data strategy for the Healthcare Cost Institute, a nonprofit organization that studies trends in healthcare costs. It may be difficult for healthcare systems to set hard parameters around which types of messages should occur, it should incur charges and which should not, he said, but he expected the trend to grow. I don't think there's going to be any going back and making it a service that's no one charges for, he said. Most things with healthcare and costs only moving in one direction when something is known to be billable, it's really not billed. You're listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Lab would like to thank UMass Lowell's WUML for providing the radio signal to allow us to broadcast 5 days a week. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back to continue reading the local news. Continue listening.
Possible too with temperatures in the upper 50s. The sun rose this morning at 6:55, sitting at 4:14 this evening. Stay tuned for more heading your way next on the Talking Information Center.
People with disabilities and people who are legally blind can now apply for free or reduced MBTA fares online. The online applications for the MBTA's free or reduced fare programs offer riders a convenient method to apply for and receive a new free or reduced fare Charlie card without having to visit the Charlie Card store. Riders can apply to these respective programs remotely and easily online from a computer or mobile device in English, Chinese, Spanish, and Portuguese. Each application allows applicants to securely enter their personal information and upload the required documents, such as a photo ID and eligibility documentation. All online applications are accessible to screen readers and were tested by free and reduced fare riders to ensure usability. Riders who submit their email address as part of their application will receive application status notifications, including details on how to use their card if approved. In addition to the online applications, the MBTA recently removed rider photos, names, and expiration dates from senior Charlie cards for people 65 and older to simplify the card fulfillment process for these riders. Riders who apply for a new or replacement senior Charlie card will now receive the new reduced fare Charlie cards for seniors, which are valid for 8 years. Riders with current senior Charlie cards can utilize them until they expire. To learn more about the MBTA's free and reduced fare programs and how to apply online, visit this website, mbta.com/fares/reduced. That again, mbta.com/fares/reduced.
What is AA? Alcoholics Anonymous is an international fellowship of men and women who've had a drinking problem.
It is non-professional and self-supporting.
AA is multiracial, apolitical, and available almost everywhere.
There are no age or education requirements. Membership is open to anyone who wants to do something about their drinking problem.
Call 617-426-9444 or find online meetings at aa-intergroup.org.
Hey, is that a faucet running?
Nope.
That's not a faucet. That's a river rushing through the forest.
It is?
Yeah. Forest rivers provide over 100 million people with clean water to drink. The water comes straight from the forest to us, in fact.
What? I can't hear you because of the vacuum.
That's not a vacuum. That's the trees in the forest cleaning up the air we breathe.
How do trees clean the air?
They soak up the dirty air on their leaves, branches, and trunks, which means clean air for us.
Cool. I didn't know that.
Yep. But the forest does more than give us clean air and water. It gives us shade for hot days, birds to listen to, and trees to climb.
Wow. That's awesome. I didn't know how cool the forest could be. Hey, let's go explore some more.
Visit the forest today and enjoy all it does, just for you. To learn more about the forest and find one near you, go to discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, play radio station Talking Information Center.
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WBBF Middleboro, WRRS Middleboro, WRRSLP Pittsfield, WLLO Londonderry, WVALLP Athol, WDJ. And Framingham.
Coming up next from the Talking Information Center is the reading of the Washington Post. Please stay tuned to hear selected articles from this newspaper.
Hello, today is Tuesday, November 29th. This will be a reading of the Washington Post. And my name is Fred. This reading will be coming to you from the Talking Information Center. Starting from the front page, the top story today is COVID's growing toll on the elderly. Let's start with that one. COVID deaths skew older, reviving questions about acceptable loss. The pandemic has become a plague of the elderly, with nearly 9 out of 10 deaths in people 65 or older. This piece is by Ariana Yucheng Char and Dan Keating. President Biden may have declared the coronavirus pandemic over, but from John Felton's view at the Yellowstone County Health, as the Yellowstone County Health Officer in Billings, Montana, it's not over, just different. Now, more than ever, it is a plague of the elderly. In October, Felton's team logged 6 deaths due to the virus, many of them among vaccinated people. Their ages, 80s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 90s. They included Betty Witzel, age 88, described by her family as a tomboy who carries snakes in her pocket, who carried snakes in her pocket as a child and grew up to be a teacher, a mother of 4, grandmother of 9, and great-grandmother of 5. And there was Nadine Alice Stark, age 85, a ranch owner who planted sugar, beets, and corn. Yellowstone County made the decision early in the crisis to recognize each death individually. And Felton said that is as important as ever to acknowledge the unrelenting toll on a still vulnerable older generation, while most everyone else has moved on. I think about someone's grandfather, the plays they wouldn't watch, the games on the football field they wouldn't see, he said. More than 300 people are still dying each day on average from COVID-19, most of them 65 or older, according to data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. That's much lower than the 2,000 daily toll at the peak of the Delta wave. It is still roughly 2 to 3 times the rate at which people die of flu, renewing debate about what is an acceptable loss. And while other Americans have consistently been the worst hit during the crisis, as evident in the scores of early nursing home deaths, that trend has become more pronounced. Today, nearly 9 in 10 COVID deaths are in people 65 or older, the highest rate ever, according to a Washington Post analysis of CDC data. Some epidemiologists and demographers predict the trend of older, sicker, and poorer people dying at disproportionate rates will continue raising hard questions about the trade-offs Americans are making in pursuit of normalcy, and at whose expense. The situation mirrors the way some other infectious diseases, such as malaria and polio, rage in the developing world while they are largely ignored elsewhere. S. Matthew Liao, professor of bioethics, philosophy, and public health at New York University, argued that it is possible to keep the economy open while still aggressively pursuing a national booster campaign in requiring masks in healthcare settings in nursing homes, for example. But U.S. leaders have chosen not to do so, he said. That worries them. There's a bit of ageism, so to speak, attached to it, he said, adding, people, even if they are older, they still have as much claim to life or as much claim to live as me or you. In an open letter published October 7th in the BMJ, formerly the British Medical Journal, Greg Gonzalez, an associate professor at the Yale School of Public Health, and about a dozen other experts emphasized that pandemics do not end up with a flip of the switch. Despite the widespread belief that the pandemic is over, death and disruption continue, they wrote. CDC Director Rochelle Walensky and other officials have justified their pandemic reset by emphasizing that Americans have more tools to fight the coronavirus than they did a year or two ago. This includes not only vaccines, booster shots, and rapid tests, but antiviral pills that can be taken at home and have been shown to greatly reduce severe illness and death if taken early. We can now prevent almost all the deaths that are happening, she said at a news briefing this month. However, Walensky acknowledged that deaths among the elderly, especially those with multiple chronic conditions, is a real challenge. An additional infection, she said, referring to COVID-19, is something that may turn something they are able to stably live with to something they are not. Epidemiologists tend to divide the pandemic into three distinct periods. In the first year, from March 2020 to March 2021, the United States experienced over 500,000 deaths. The toll was about the same the following year. In the third year, the nation is on track to lower that count significantly to 150,000 to 175,000 deaths, barring a curveball in the form of a new variant. That means that coronavirus is likely to rank third as a cause of death this year. By comparison, heart disease and cancer kill roughly 600,000 people each year. Accidents, 170,000. Stroke, 150,000. Alzheimer's, 120,000. Flu, in contrast, kills 12,000 to 52,000. A recent CDC report on COVID-19 mortality contained more good news, most notably a rapid drop in deaths beginning in March that led to a relatively stable period from April through September, when there were 2,000 to 4,500 deaths weekly. But the reduced death toll has not been experienced equally among all age groups. Unlike flu, which impacts both the very young and the very old, the coronavirus appears to put mostly older people at higher risk of severe disease and death. The proportion of deaths among those 65 or older has fluctuated from 8 out of 10 in the last few months of the pandemic to a low of 6 out of 10 when the Delta wave struck in the summer of 2021, to a high of 9 out of 10 today. Last month, let me back up to this chart here. COVID deaths concentrated more than ever in the elderly. The share of COVID deaths, the share of COVID deaths in this country among people aged 75 or older is at the highest level of the pandemic. Younger people made up a larger share of deaths during the Delta wave in the summer of 2021. So, yeah, at first it was spread out among age groups, and now it's concentrated. Last month, people 85 and older represented 41.4% of deaths. Those 75 to 84 were 30% of deaths. Those 65 to 74 were 17.5% of deaths, according to a post-analysis. All told, the 65-plus age group accounted for nearly 90% of COVID deaths in the United States, despite being only 16% of the population. The vulnerability of older people to viruses is neither surprising nor new. The more we age, the more we accumulate scars from previous illness and chronic conditions that put us at higher risk of severe illness. When it comes to the coronavirus, though, deaths in Americans over 65 fell dramatically after the arrival of the original series of vaccines, since seniors were the most likely to get them. But booster rates for older Americans are now lagging. According to the CDC, 98% of those ages 65 to 74 and 96% of people 75 and older completed an initial two-shot course. Those rates fall to 22 and 25% respectively for the new Omicron-specific booster. To minimize further loss of life ahead of a feared winter surge, the White House announced Tuesday that it was launching a six-week push to increase booster uptake in seniors and other groups that have been disproportionately affected. The final message I give you from this podium is that please, for your own safety, for that of your family, get an updated COVID-19 shot as soon as you're eligible to protect yourself, your family, and your community, Anthony Fauci, the president's chief medical advisor, said during the briefing, billed as his last before he retires next month. The issue of age in the pandemic has been a source of tension throughout the pandemic. When hospitals were hit with a crush of patients in the spring of 2020, some of the debates about allocating scarce resources centered on age. In documents drafted by some medical institutions, stage of life, a proxy for age, was sometimes recommended to be used as a tiebreaker in decisions about who should get a ventilator or a bed. A number of experts, including Dr. Lael, expressed discomfort with such rankings. I really disagree with that view, he said. You can imagine a 70-year-old who can do everything, can enjoy friendship, read books, and go to movies. Joe Rowland, parish nurse at the Harvest Church in Billings, whose job includes supporting congregation members and their families through COVID illnesses and death, said society failed many of its elderly in another way, too, through safety protocols at the beginning of the pandemic that left them to die alone. As more continue to fall victim to the virus, she added, we need to be more thoughtful about how to celebrate their lives and treat their deaths with dignity. It's a different type of grief losing an older person, she said. While some fault COVID-19 policies for not doing enough to protect the elderly, others criticize age-based policies implemented elsewhere. In the United Kingdom, for example, a matrix of recommendations based on age left some seniors feeling they were being discriminated against. Even as stores and restaurants began to open in the summer of 2020, the National Health Service still advised people 70 and older to stay home or shield. In Colombia, the government sought to protect older people by closing centers that offered activities for them through August 2020. The policies became controversial for restricting freedom of movement. Alfred Dürer Merck, a geriatric nurse from the University of Liverpool, and others wrote in a journal article in August that many older people felt angry and frustrated that their individuality was ignored. The undifferentiated way in which, especially the role of age, as a risk factor was discussed, and the inclusion of all people above the age of 65 into one homogeneous risk group, often neglected, the diversity of older people and their characteristics, and thus drew criticism for fueling ageism in society, the authors wrote. Terrace Swanigan's father was in the first wave of deaths that occurred in 2020. Charles Krebs had celebrated his 75th birthday shortly before he was infected in July. He had retired from his job as an appraiser in Phoenix and was spending his time reading, gardening, picking up his grandson from school, and accompanying him to his football games. He was strong and extraordinarily healthy, Swanigan recalled, but the virus nonetheless ravished his lungs, and he had to be put on a ventilator. He died that August. Swanigan said she was heartened to hear about President Biden's campaign to encourage older Americans to get booster shots, but she and other women, she and other members of Marked by COVID, a nonprofit founded by two women who lost parents to the virus, advocate for more protections for people who are vulnerable, such as additional coronavirus testing. She continues to be shocked by how callous some people have been when she has talked about her father's death. "Well, your dad was super old," she recalled one man telling her on social media. "For seniors in the immunocompromised, it's almost like we're saying, you don't matter, you don't matter, we'd rather just not be inconvenienced," she said. Masks are a particular pain point. "I was usually disappointed when they took away the mask mandates for airplanes and other public transportation," she said, given the minimal disruption to daily life from face coverings and their major impact on curbing transmission, according to studies. She does not understand why public health leaders have stopped promoting their use. Even one of the most recognizable seniors during the pandemic, Fauci, the National Institutes of Health scientist who is 81, no longer wears a face covering in many public appearances. In pictures from 2020, Fauci was always seen with a mask, even when he threw the ceremonial first pitch that year on Major League Baseball opening day between the New York Yankees and the Washington Nationals, and was outdoors and 60 feet away from another human being, he was masked. But last month, when the infectious disease doctor...
Top of the morning to you, folks. You are listening to the Loyal Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Lab would like to thank UMass Lowell's WUML-FM for providing the radio signal that allows us to broadcast 5 days a week. This is Joanne, and I'm going to read to you from the Lowell Sun, and it's Monday's edition, November 28th. The holiday spirit lights up Lowell. Though the temperatures are a little toasty in comparison to what he's used to way up north, Santa Claus still wore his usual white fur-trimmed red jacket and matching stocking cap during the City of Lights parade on Saturday. Jolly old St. Nick brought up the back end of the parade, and he sat in his sleigh, which rather than being pulled by Rudolph and the rest of the flying reindeer, was instead hauled along the route by the Department of Public Works truck. Before the parade took off late Saturday afternoon, Mayor Zachary Chow predicted a large crowd for this year's City of Lights Festival, known as Lowell's Merriest of Holiday Events. The mayor's prediction was spot on, as thousands of people lined the sidewalks along the length of the parade route, which began on Jackson Street, turned onto Central Street, then to Merrimack Street, before concluding by City Hall. "You will see today, from all walks of life," Chow said, "different age groups, different neighborhoods. I think the city is built on traditions, and it's very important for everyone to carry on this tradition for ourselves and for our children." Almost certainly adding to the crowd's numbers on Saturday were the sunny, mostly blue skies, along with temperatures that stayed in the 50s throughout the afternoon. The almost 70-year festival was held last year after taking 2020 off to the coronavirus pandemic. Caitlin Goodrich of Lowell, who attends the parade annually with her family, said there was a clear spike in attendance on Saturday compared to the festival showing last year. Bigger crowd, better weather, and the parade seemed to have more stuff, she said. Nicole Gross, who captains the Lowell chapter of the Salvation Army with her husband, Timothy Ross, agreed with Goodrich's sentiment. The local Salvation Army participates in a parade each year, according to Nicole Ross, who said Saturday's attendance mirrored the festival's numbers prior to the hiatus. "We're getting back," she said. "It feels good. We're kicking off the season right." In addition to Santa Claus and the Salvation Army, the musical and colorful parade include the Grinch driving a school bus, school marching bands, antique cars, festive floats, and members of the Lowell Kinetic Sculpture Race, who were on hand with several unique pieces of drivable artwork. Though it was a big part of the event, the festival offered much more than the parade. Throughout the day, visitors could wander downtown streets to listen to Victorian carolers, bid on wreaths, make crafts, and even take in the holiday movie Frozen. The parade also showcased talents of downtown businesses, such as Little Delights Bakery, which hosted a holiday cookie decorating workshop. Also, several restaurants participated in a hot chocolate competition. The restaurants are ready to roll, and we are very excited to showcase the downtown with all the glitz and glamour and the happiness, most importantly, of the holiday season, said City Manager Tom Golden. Joanne Gunby and her husband Craig Fergal, owners of Gourmand's Cafe, located on Market Street, were one of the shops that competed for the title of Best Hot Chocolate in Lowell. Gunby and Fergal were busy handing out shot glass-sized cups of hot chocolate with whipping cream on top to the packs of people who came in to give their recipe a try on Saturday afternoon. According to Gunby, they offered a ginger-based hot chocolate crafted by Fergal, the chef at Gourmand's Cafe. "I love it," Gunby said about the festival. "I love anything that gets people out to downtown and walking around. It's a nice, fun, family event for everybody." The festival concluded after the parade with city officials and Santa himself counting down with the crowd before throwing the switch for the lighting of City Hall and the Wanawansett Smokestack Christmas tree. The sea of people gathered around JFK Plaza let out a massive cheer as the holiday lights came to life and shined down on them. "To have a ceremony like this in the city of Lowell gets everybody out to celebrate together," Charles said. "It's a unifying event and gets everybody into the holiday spirit and gives everyone a sense of community." Very nice. All right. Weather forecast. Get ready for the wind before strong cold front. After a rainy end to the holiday weekend, more blustery conditions are set to descend upon the Boston area for the start of the work week ahead of a potentially strong cold front later in the week. The National Weather Service's Boston office is monitoring that patent cold weather, which is expected to push through New England Wednesday night into Thursday with possible heavy rainfall and gusty winds. There's a chance for some snow in parts of Massachusetts with this system. There are a lot of moving parts to this system, so we still have to nail down the timing of it. Rodney Chai, meteorologist in the National Weather Service's Boston office, told the Herald on Sunday. In that Wednesday to Thursday time frame, it could bring widespread rain, some very strong winds to the region, and even some snow in the higher elevations, Chai said. The Thanksgiving holiday weekend ended with some raw conditions as a low-pressure system brought rain and gusty winds to southern New England on a busy travel day. The National Weather Service was warning about possible coastal flooding during Sunday afternoon's high tide, especially for Cape Cod and Nantucket. All right. Let's see. Police. Another crash leads to DUI charge. Pelham, New Hampshire. A motor vehicle crash in Pelham resulted in a driving under the influence charge for the third time in less than 4 days, police said. Matthew Poff, 22, of Pelham, was charged with DUI during the early morning hours on Sunday, following a single vehicle crash on Winnemem Drive, according to a Pelham Police Department press release. Police said an investigation determined at about 2:30 a.m. a 2013 Subaru Impreza, operated by Poff, exited the roadway for approximately 50 feet before striking a granite post. I turn the page, which snapped into two pieces. The vehicle then crossed back over the road before coming to a rest on the lawn of 50 Grandin Drive. Poff was the lone occupant of the vehicle, was uninjured in the crash. In addition to DUI, police said Poff was charged with two counts of criminal mischief. The 22-year-old was released on his own recognizance and is slated to appear in Salem District Court for arraignment at 8 a.m. December 5th. Sunday morning crash was the third wreck in Pelham that led to a DUI charge since Wednesday. Police arrested Paul Tripko, 61, of Methuen, Massachusetts, after he allegedly caused a three-vehicle wreck at the intersection of Bridge Street and Beacon Hill Road at about 3 p.m. Wednesday. On Thanksgiving night, police arrested Ramon Rodriguez, 30, of Chelmsford, Massachusetts, following a single vehicle crash on Bush Hill Road. There were no serious injuries reported in any of the crashes. All right. Let's see. Let's do the 5-minute read. MCC joins Lowell Police Community Partners for 8th Annual Toy Drive. The Lowell Police Department is partnering with students at Middlesex Community College's Criminal and Social Justice Department to collect gifts for the 8th Annual Lowell Police Holiday Toy Drive. Students in the Criminal and Social Justice Department, under the leadership of Department Chair and Professor Halisa DeCunha, will assist the Holiday Toy Drive as a service learning project. Six students in the Law, Justice, and Society class will collect toys from the Middlesex Community College's Lowell and Bedford campuses. The toys will be transported to the Lowell Police Department for sorting. The students will then help sort the toys and match them to age-appropriate wish lists. The annual toy drive, which accepts donations from community partners, delivered over 1,000 toys to city families last year. This year's toys and gifts that are collected will be distributed directly to Lowell children in need by Lowell Public Schools social workers, House of Hope, a shelter for families, and Bridget's Crossing, a shelter for teenage mothers in Lowell. New, unused, and unwrapped toys will be accepted at donation kiosks at the Lowell Police Department on Arkham Drive on the Bedford and Lowell campuses of MCC and at other locations throughout the community. Billerica Police recognized for contributions to Cops for Kids with Cancer. The Billerica Police Department was recognized for Cops for Kids with Cancer, a nonprofit that works to support the families of children with cancer at the Billerica Select Board meeting on November 21st. Cops for Kids with Cancer began as a bet between two police officers in Boston who gave funds to hospitals to support pediatric cancer patients and later began supporting families directly. The organization has supported 914 families with over $4.75 million in funds that are provided to support families in any way they need. The organization provides families with a $5,000 check to spend as needed. Billerica Police have supported Cops for Kids with Cancer for about 15 years. For about half that time, funding for the nonprofit has come from all sworn officers of the department, contributing $2 per week from their paycheck. Most departments contribute to the organization via fundraisers and events, but the Billerica Police wanted to establish more consistent funding. Sergeant Mark Sukalis came up with the idea of donating a small piece of our paychecks every week, just a small amount, so we could have guaranteed income for our donations to the organization, Chief Roy Frost said. Now we're able to fund a $5,000 check for a family on a yearly basis. That's wonderful. The Billerica Police Department has donated $24,481 to the nonprofit since January 2016. Lowell Chamber Orchestra to hold Island of Peoples concert in December. The Lowell Chamber Orchestra will be performing Islands of Peoples, a multimedia concert based on stories of immigrants coming to the U.S. at 7:30 p.m. Saturday, December 17th. The concert draws inspiration and material from the stories of the Ellis Island Oral Histories, a project of the Ellis Island Museum that preserves and collects interviews of immigrants who went through Ellis Island between 1900 and 1954. The concert will include original material obtained directly from actual immigrant interviews. The concert will take place at Middlesex Community College's Richard and Nancy Donahue Academy Academic Arts Center at 230 Central Street. The concert is free to attend, but donations can be made at lowellchamberorchestra.org/Island of Peoples Fundraiser. Okay, let me take a little sip of my coffee. All right. Okay. Local news. New Hampshire housing costs keep rising. National New Hampshire. I'm sorry. Done. That's cold when the city mails you with the December property tax bill right before Christmas and due on December 20th, 2022. By the way, interest will begin to accrue on December 21st, 2022, at a rate of 8%. Gee, thanks, City Hall, and Merry Christmas to all. Fa-la-la-la-la.
I love my hometown of Nashua just as many of you treasure where you come from. But these days, the Gate City is morphing into a place I barely recognize. It's become quite expensive to live here. That's if you can actually find appropriate housing and can afford it. I recently opened my tax bill envelope and thought it was a typo. I had two friends call me screaming, "What the H is this? Who does the mayor think he is?" Well, it is what it is. Here, property taxes are paid in two installments. The first one comes in July. Now, in December, I'm paying about $700 more 6 months later. Yeah, I'm fuming along with many others. Me included, folks. I just moved to New Hampshire back in Nashua back in 2019. So, okay, I missed this recent accolade in October. Nashua was named in Money Magazine's Best 50 Places to Live. My city came out 44th, which is still a feather in our cap. Money's reporter boasted how the Gate City's unemployment is among the lowest on the magazine's list at 2.3% APR. But homeowners do pay one of the highest property tax rates in the U.S., around 2%, and the median home in Nashua costs $368,733 today, Money Magazine stated. Affordable housing remains a serious challenge for most New Hampshire cities and towns. Back in March, I wrote a column here about folks being priced out of today's housing market. The encouraging news then was the demolition of the former Bronstein Apartments, a 48-unit public housing development in downtown at 41 Central Street in Nashua's historic New Yard District. The project has been to the construction of Monahan Manor, a larger housing complex comprised of four-story apartments, buildings, featuring 216 multifamily units with 206 affordable housing units on the 4.3 acres of land there. Talk about progress. All four tall apartment buildings are standing less than a year later. That's impressive. I'm sure when these apartments will be open, I'm unsure when these apartments will be open for occupancy. Downtown living is convenient for residents because they're within walking distance of shops, restaurants, parks, employment, public transportation, etc. And Nashua is a superb walkable city. But not every individual enjoys seeing too many apartment developments sprouting in the city's downtown. Manchester is tackling that issue right now. The state's largest city has at least a dozen construction projects planned for the Queen City. But some residents say enough is enough. They believe that Manchester's downtown is becoming overly saturated and too close for comfort. Brady Sullivan Properties is proposing 110 units in a downtown office building it owns located at 1228 to 1230 Elm Street. Nearby Amaskeag Terrace, condominium residents are afraid their property values will decrease and their neighborhood will no longer enjoy its quiet atmosphere. They argue that Brady Sullivan is ignoring issues such as pedestrian safety, increased traffic, a lack of parking, and the use of an alley. Stay tuned on that one. Meanwhile, I suppose one could ask, downtown density and housing, what is it too much of a good thing? Well, folks, I was happy to know that my home went double since I bought it. But when I ever saw that my tax bill, it increased $900. I just got the bill a couple of weeks ago. Where am I supposed to get $900? And where is anyone supposed to get that kind of money within a few weeks? It just isn't right. All right. Moving on. Let's see. Italy. Body of girl found in mudslide. Death toll rises to 2. Milan. Search teams pulled the body of a young girl from her family home on Sunday as they dug through mud for a second day in the search for people still missing after an enormous landslide on the Italian resort island of Ischia. The Naples prefect confirmed that the death toll in the tragedy had risen to 2, following also the recovery of the body of a 31-year-old woman from the island on Saturday. A further 10 people remained missing in the port town of Casamicciola, feared buried under mud and debris. Mud and water tend to fill every space. The spokesperson for Italian firefighters, Luca Calli, told RAI State TV, "Our teams are searching with hope, even if it is very difficult. Our biggest hope is that people identified as missing have found refuge with relatives and friends and have not advised of their position," he added. The risks of landslides remained in the highest part of the town, near where heavy rainfall loosened a chunk of mountainslide, requiring search teams to enter by foot, he said. Small bulldozers focused on clearing roads overnight to allow rescue vehicles to pass, while dive teams were brought in to check cars that had been pushed into the sea. "We are continuing the search with our hearts broken, because among the missing are also minors." The mayor of the neighboring town of Lecco Ameno told RAI. Pope Francis expressed his closeness to the people of Ischia during the traditional Sunday blessing at St. Peter's Square. "I am praying for the victims, for those who are suffering, and for those who are involved in the rescue," he said. The Naples prefect said Claudio Palomba said on Sunday that 15 homes had been overwhelmed by the stream of mud. In addition to the dead and missing, 4 people were injured and more than 160 displaced. The massive landslide before dawn on Saturday was triggered by exceptional rainfall and sent a mass of mud and debris hurtling through the port of Casamicciola, collapsing buildings and sweeping vehicles into the sea. One widely circulated video showed a man covered with mud clinging to a shutter, chest deep in muddy water. The island received 126 millimeters, that's nearly 5 inches, of rain in 6 hours. The heaviest rainfall in 20 years, according to officials. Experts said the disaster was exacerbated by building in areas of high risk on the mountainous island, which is also in a seismically active zone. 2 people were killed in 2017 when a 4.0 magnitude quake struck the island in Lecco Ameno. There is territory that cannot be occupied. You cannot change the use of a zone where there is water. The course of the water created this disaster. Geologist Riccardo Canaparoni told RAI, "There were norms and laws that were not respected." Vincenzo De Luca, president of the Campania region where Ischia is located, said houses in areas of at risk must be demolished, suggesting that they have built without necessary permits. People need to understand that you cannot live in some areas. There is no such thing as the necessity to build illegally, Zuluka told RAI. Buildings in fragile zones should be demolished, the Italian government declared a state of emergency for the island during an urgent cabinet meeting Sunday, earmarking 2 million euros, that's nearly $2.1 million, for the rescue and to restore public services. The government expresses its closeness to the citizens, mayors, and towns of the island of Ischia, and thanks to rescue workers searching for the victims, Premier Giorgia Meloni said in a statement. Our thoughts and prayers are with you. All right. Georgia's Senate runoff between Warnock and Walter has been closing. Let me take a sip. Okay. Warner Robins, Georgia. As with the candidate's ex-wives, cries of liar flying in both directions. Stories of a squalid apartment building and abortions under pressure. Questioning an opponent's independence, his intellect, his mental stability, his religious faith. The extended Senate campaign in Georgia between the Democratic incumbent Raphael Warnock and his Republican challenger, football legend Herschel Walker, has grown increasingly bitter as the December 6th runoff nears. With Democrats already assured a Senate majority, it's a striking contrast from 2 years ago when the state's twin runoffs were mostly about which party would control the chamber in Washington. Excuse me. Herschel Walker ain't serious, Warnock told supporters recently in central Georgia, saying that Walker majors in lying and fumbles the basics of public policy. But the election is very serious. Don't get those two things confused. Walker cast Warnock, the senior pastor at Ebenezer Baptist Church, as a hypocrite and servile to President Joe Biden. Underscoring the insult, Walker calls the incumbent Scooby-Doo, complete with an impression of the cartoon hound's gibberish. The both sides reflect the candidate's furious push in the 4 weeks between the November 8th general election and runoff to persuade their core supporters to cast another ballot. For Walker, excuse me, it almost means, I lost my place. For Walker, it also means drawing more independents and moderates to his campaign after he underperformed a fellow Republican on the ticket, Governor Brian Kemp, by 200,000 votes. Warnock led Walker by 37,000 votes out of almost 4 million cast in the first round, but the senator fell short of the 50% threshold needed to avoid a runoff. In many ways, the shift from his first runoff campaign is exactly what Warnock wanted, a straightforward choice between two candidates. 2 years ago, then-President Donald Trump, fresh off his defeat, and Biden, then-president-elect, made multiple Georgia trips to eliminate the national stakes of the races between Warnock and Republican Senator Kelly Loeffler, and between Democrat John Ossoff and Republican Senator
David Perdue as control of the Senate hung in the balance. Trump ended up alienating his own supporters and many moderates with his false claims of a rigged 2020 presidential election. Victories by Warnock and Ossoff put the Senate at a 50-50 split, with Democrats gaining control by virtue of Vice President Kamala Harris's tie-breaking vote. Warnock also became Georgia's first black senator. Well, folks, you're going to stop name-calling and just debate the issues. All right. Okay. This is an editorial from the Lowell Sun. DACA recipients need permanent relief. One of the first issues most Americans can agree on when it comes to the thorny topic of immigration is that long-time residents who were brought into the United States illegally as children should be granted permanent status. Congress should seize the opportunity during the lame duck session to pass such legislation before the end of the year. With the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals policy in peril in federal court, California Senator Alex Padilla has joined other Democratic senators to corral support to pass bipartisan legislation after Thanksgiving that will provide a permanent solution for these immigrants whose fates have been in limbo for years. Legislation could be a standalone bill or language attached to a must-pass government spending bill. Either way, such legislation would need the support of at least 10 Republicans and all 50 Democrats to pass. Padilla, who heads the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Immigration, Citizenship, and Border Safety, is appealing to common sense, making the case to Republicans that offering permanent residency to immigrants who've lived in the country most of their lives and work in essential jobs boosts the economy. It's a last-ditch effort to resolve a problem that's hounded legislators for decades. There's a short window of opportunity before Republicans take over control of the House, closing the door for at least 2 more years on any permanent fix. The House passed a bill to give juniors legal status in 2021. It's time for the Senate to approve the legislation, which will allow it to reach President Joe Biden's desk soon. President Barack Obama created DACA by executive order in 2012 after Congress failed to pass a bill that would have offered young immigrants who met certain requirements the opportunity for legal residency. DACA has allowed more than 800,000 young immigrants in the United States to live, work, and travel legally, but it was intended to be a temporary solution. It has survived legal challenges, but its fate will now be decided by a U.S. District Judge who earlier had ruled in a lawsuit filed by several states led by Texas, arguing that DACA is illegal. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit has sent the case back to the judge for a final resolution. Instead of waiting for the resolution of that federal court case, Congress must find a way to offer permanent relief to the immigrants we've come to know as dreamers, who are thoroughly American and have built lives here as college students, entrepreneurs, essential workers, and valued members of every community. Is this a long shot? Perhaps. But now would be a good time to remember that the original DREAM Act was introduced in 2001 by Utah Republican Senator Orrin Hatch, and combined elements of two bills sponsored by Democratic and Republican legislators.
the DREAM Act's initial bipartisan support eroded dramatically in the weeks after the 9/11 attack heightened security concerns. Since then, various attempts to revive different versions of the DREAM Act have fallen short in Congress because Republicans want stricter border controls. The border has been fortified in many ways through the years, yet the fate of DREAMers and other undocumented immigrants remains uncertain. DACA now symbolizes the long-standing failure of federal lawmakers to craft much-needed comprehensive immigration reform. Poll after poll through the years show that most Americans want DACA recipients to be allowed to remain legally in the U.S. An analysis conducted by the Conservative American Enterprise Institute in 2017 at the height of Trump's anti-immigrant hysteria found that Americans' general feelings toward immigrants and immigration have become more positive in recent years. Of course, some people may prefer to have DACA recipients leave the country, perhaps thinking that these immigrants are a financial drain on taxpayers. But DREAMers contribute about $6.2 billion in federal taxes and $3.3 billion in state and local taxes annually. According to the Nonpartisan Center for American Progress, granting DREAMers permanent status is of paramount importance for California, which is home to approximately 170,000 of the 600,000 current DACA recipients nationwide. It's time for senators to put aside the differences and show leadership in addressing the fate of DREAMers. I mean, come on, folks. Aren't we all our ancestors DREAMers at one time? Everybody came over here from every country in Europe, South America, everywhere, Africa, and you know, it's time. It's really time. All right. Let's see if I have anything else to read. A little something on nutrition. Spirulina, green tea, and potential benefits. Richard D., who reads his column in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, writes, "I'm age 82 and in good health compared to most men of my age that I know. Spirulina, I recently started adding half a teaspoon of it to my breakfast. What are your ideas about it? Green tea, I've started drinking it because it is supposedly beneficial. How does an individual ever know whether it is helpful? Since I have osteopenia, my endocrinologist wants me to eat more protein and reduce the quantity of leafy green veggies. Have you written an article about the nutritional value of beans? You write quite clearly, so it is easy to understand the topic. It would not surprise me if your minor was in English or literature. Sounds like you're taking good care of yourself, Richard. Let's whittle away at your questions. Spirulina is a type of blue-green algae, organisms that live in the water and produce energy from the sun. A recent review in the journal Molecules gives a nutritional thumbs up to spirulina. It is high in protein and other essential nutrients, including vitamin B12, which is often lacking in plant-based diets. Spirulina also remains a host of compounds that helps the body fight inflammation and boost the immune system. extracts of its blue-green pigments have been approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration as natural color additives for a variety of foods and confection. And get this, NASA has used spirulina as a dietary supplement for astronauts. Some cautions do remain, however. People with autoimmune disorders such as multiple sclerosis or those on immune suppression drugs should avoid spirulina supplements due to its immune-stimulating effect. And because some unregulated products may contain unwanted contaminants, pregnant and breastfeeding women, as well as young children, should avoid it.